Rachel Larby, Wheel 4.
My parents had gone to Tanzania for 6 months to work in a small mission hospital, my father, to teach surgery. And the British Red Cross had said to me that there was a post coming up in Bosnia, which they would suggest me for. And I thought that I really ought to go and tell my parents this personally, rather than just write them a letter and say, "Hi, I'm off to Bosnia." So I just turned up in Tanzania one day and walked in, and they were overjoyed. Obviously, it was completely unannounced. And then I told them that I was going to work in Bosnia. And as I say, I kind of didn't give much thought to how they might be feeling, and they were only supportive, and I can only thank them for that. They were marvellous. But as my mother has said to me, if it's what I really want to do, then she's happy, and I think that's what most mothers ultimately feel. And she's also said, my mother, that if she hadn't married and had so many children and done what she'd done, she would have liked to have done what I'd have done. So I suppose partly I get it from my parents anyway. So they gave me their blessing, and I went off to Bosnia. I went in May 1993.
Did you have any special training from the Red Cross?
Well, I'd had the week's delegates training course that I'd mentioned before, which wasn't specific to working in Bosnia. That was general delegates training course for Red Cross situations around the world. I then had a thorough briefing before this post with the British Red Cross in London, and a briefing in Geneva at the headquarters of the ICRC. So I felt I was reasonably well briefed for what I was going to do. It's difficult, I think, in any situation, any relief situation, to specifically describe what somebody's job's going to be, because you can't possibly know. And for me, that's part of the fun, really. That's part of the enjoyment, is facing the unknown and not knowing what each day is going to bring, and being prepared for it, and being able to cope with absolutely anything, whatever comes your way. So nobody can really prepare you, and I think you're either the sort of person who relishes that and rises to it and thrives on it, or you're not. And if you're not, then you don't do this kind of work. So I was briefed in London, and then one day in Geneva, and then again in Zagreb, which is the capital of Croatia, where the ICRC's headquarters for former Yugoslavia are based.
Can you remember any sort of features of your briefing, what you were sort of told to do and not to do?
Absolutely. Well, each time it gets more specific. In London, I was just told that I was going to be a field nurse for the ICRC in former Yugoslavia, and completed the formalities for working outside UK. In Geneva, I was explained the setup of the ICRC former Yugoslavia mission. I was saw the medical director, because I was going to be part of ICRC's medical programme, and he explained the different medical units functioning for the ICRC in former Yugoslavia and where they were. Then I saw the personnel advisor, who said it will be traumatic. You need to cry, you need to laugh, you need to talk to people, you need to make sure you sleep well, you rest well, you eat well, and you get out for your breaks. That is very important, she said, that in conflict zones, the ICRC has rules whereby each person needs to come out of their situation for a weekend every so often, depending on where you are. Sometimes it's every month, sometimes it's every 6 weeks, sometimes it's every 3 weeks, depending on the severity of the place where you are. So I went sort of well-armed with all these things buzzing around in my head. And then I got to Zagreb and had, I think it was a four-day briefing, along with other new delegates, because with the ICRC, former Yugoslavia mission, people are coming and going all the time. Most people are on six-month contracts. Some are only on three, and often you can extend those at the discretion of your head.
What sort of contract were you on?
I was on a six-month contract at this stage. So the four-day briefing in Zagreb was along with other new delegates coming at the same time. So there was myself, there was somebody from the Australian Red Cross, somebody from the French Red Cross, and two others from ICRC, so they were Swiss. And we were all briefed together, and we had very intensive briefings individually about our own particular work, and also together on the political situation and on the security situation. So I remember particularly the security one, obviously, all about the importance of wearing flak jackets and helmets in places where it was dangerous, where there was shelling. Never getting out of the car at checkpoints, always turning off the car engine at checkpoints, turning off the radio, winding down the window, speaking politely. All these things which get drummed into you so that you do them as second nature. The conflict in former Yugoslavia is so different in different parts of that country, or what was that country. Obviously, the security briefing for Sarajevo is very different from the security briefing for Zagreb. So you needed to take into account what was relevant for the area that you were going to. At that stage, I was not going to Sarajevo, so I didn't have to listen too intensely to what was going on there. But mostly the area where I was going, it was just going to be crossing the front line a lot of times. So learning how to behave at checkpoints, to be polite to soldiers, not to rile them, not to shout, not to raise your voice, not to get angry, just to be patient and courteous at all times. And that you are representing the ICRC, which is very important because they are neutral and they need to maintain that neutrality and to be seen to be maintaining that neutrality. And it's only that that allows us such freedom of movement across the front lines and to work equally on both sides. And that can be lost in a twinkling by one rash word or one unwise thing that you say or do. And that's more than just a personal thing. That could actually jeopardise the whole ICRC work in former Yugoslavia. And I think I was so terrified of that. I took that greatly to heart.
Was that genuine, the neutrality? You know, the organisation's neutrality? Do you think it really was genuine?
I think so, yes. And I'm not just saying that because I worked for the ICRC. I think it was. I think it's not always easy to feel that way. And there are many times afterwards when I certainly lost my neutrality in my heart. But one thing is to think, it's one thing to think and feel one thing, it's another to show it. And you have to maintain an outward air of neutrality because you could not work if you didn't. And it's so important, vitally important, for the ICRC to be seen to be neutral. And that was emphasised time and again afterwards when UNHCR were not permitted to do things, to go to places, and ICRC was. And the UNHCR, purely because it's a UN agency and therefore it was linked with UNPROFOR and linked with airstrikes and linked with hating the Serbs, as they felt. And it's so easy to understand how those misassumptions can happen. Or perhaps they're not misassumptions. I mean, UNHCR is a UN agency. The ICRC had to be seen to be different. And there are many in the ICRC who would say that they didn't feel that strongly enough in Bosnia. It was not seen to be different enough. I hadn't had previous conflict zone experience with ICRC to know how their neutrality had worked before. But I felt it was working well enough in Bosnia because there were times when I was permitted to pass checkpoints that others were not. So, yes, I think it is vital, and although I didn't always feel it in my heart, I hope I always maintained it outwardly. So my first 6 months I was field nurse in a number of places, from Knin to Bihać to Banja Luka. The reason I was in a number of places was because the hot spots moved around. And the field nurse's role is really to be in the place where the greatest need is for the supply of surgical things for war-wounded people. So normally the ICRC has field hospitals and has nurses, doctors, surgeons, anaesthetists and the like for the treatment, surgical treatment of war-wounded soldiers, civilians, it doesn't matter who. In former Yugoslavia, it was slightly different because the country has its own doctors and nurses and surgeons and anaesthetists. What they didn't have was the supplies. They didn't have the operating equipment. They didn't have the antibiotics, the analgesics, the scalpels, the intravenous fluids, the dressings, the absolutely everything, because the country had collapsed and there was just no system and no money for these things. So the ICRC was supplying them. So as a field nurse, the job was to visit the frontline hospitals and structures that received war wounded, estimate their needs and bring in the supplies for those needs. So obviously you do need to be where the major battles are. The first place I was sent was a place called Knin, which is in the Krajina, which is the part of Croatia, if you're Croat you'd call it that, if you're Serbs you'd call it Serbia, Croatia I shall say, but inhabited by the Serbs. And a very heavily disputed territory that actually goes back longer than this present conflict. So it was an area where Serbs were fighting Croats. And the casualties had been very high. They'd had quite a lot of battles around there. But by the time I was sent there in early 92, or April, May 92, the shelling around that area was... Sorry, 93, I beg your pardon. The shelling around there was dying down and it was not so busy as it had been. And so it was decided that I should move to Bihać Pocket. Now that is the northwest corner of Bosnia, which many people have heard of since. Bihać is a Muslim corner of Bosnia, which is called a pocket because it geographically literally is a small sort of pocket of land that's cut off and surrounded by Serbs and Croats. Serbs on the eastern side further into Bosnia and Croats around the western side and going towards Zagreb. Bihać at that time was being quite heavily shelled from the Serbs and so it was busy supplying a lot of surgical things to the hospital there. And those things were brought in by truck overland through the Krajina. So we did have to cross a lot of checkpoints there. And actually, I got to know the soldiers on the checkpoints quite well. And that's nice because they know you're a person and you're doing your job, and they're a person and they're doing their job. And it apoliticises it, really, if you like. And I mean, officially, that checkpoint closed at dusk, I think. But there were many times when I was crossing that checkpoint late at night and after dark. And although the checkpoint was officially closed, the soldiers had to be there to man it, but they'd be in their hut drinking shivovitz or something. And if it was me, and not just me, but they'd see the Red Cross vehicle with the flag and the emblem on the side and let me through. So that was nice, and certainly it was easy to maintain good relations with these people. And that helped as well for later on when sometimes we needed to evacuate people who'd been badly injured or who had some illness that was unable to be treated in Bihać and they needed to get out to Zagreb where they had access to a greater variety of medical care, and we'd take them across the border checkpoint. And that was certainly eased when you knew the soldiers were on the checkpoint and the soldiers knew you.
Did you have to go through shelling and sort of sniper fire?
At that time, no. Later on I did. There was shelling, as I say, in Bihać. Usually, when I was going to Bihać and there was shelling, I would get to the ICRC delegation in Bihać and stay there because it was in an old hotel which was heavily barricaded so that all the windows were protected with great big concrete barricades which had been placed up beside the building and then heavily sandbagged. So we'd just stay inside the delegation if there was shelling and not go anywhere. I mean, it was a day's wasted in a way. Didn't go out. We didn't have armoured vehicles. Later, when I worked in Sarajevo, we had armoured Land Rovers. So it was very unwise and stupid to try and drive around. We had just ordinary four-wheel drive Land Cruisers.
What was the degree of devastation while you were there in
Bihać?
Bihać, yes.
Sporadic. There were parts of the town where the Serbs targeted and aimed that were the heavily destroyed flats, totally unlivable in. I mean, every flat shell hole. Not the building, maybe not completely fallen down, but huge great holes in it, and so that the structure was unsound. Other parts of town would be untouched, but nowhere was totally free from the effects of shelling, because there'd be so much debris flying around and windows would shatter. So most buildings would have broken windows or sort of pock marks from some debris that had hit them. And every single building was protected anyway. People would barricade the windows and sandbag their houses. So signs of the war were visible everywhere, though parts of the town were much more destroyed than other parts.
Was it an old town, Bihac?
Yes.
Or is it an old town?
It is. Mm. I believe, since I left Bihac, that it was much more heavily shelled later. So it may be much worse. Well, I'm sure it's much worse now than it was when I was there. But the centre of Bihac is an old town. It's got a river running through it. I can't remember the name of the river at the moment. And quite attractive. Lots of trees, plenty of shady cafes and restaurants along the riverside where you could sit and eat. Very nice, very pleasant old town, Bihac. And then, like all towns around the edges, more modern houses have been built as the town has grown and spread. And so it has old and new. The hospital was quite old, and the hospital was targeted, believe me. Whatever you hear said, hospitals were targets in this war. One of the things the ICRC constantly said to both sides, both all parties in the confrontation, was that hospitals should be respected and should not be shelled. And both all sides of the confrontation would say, yes, we agree, we won't shell the hospitals, and you know, it's not a deliberate attack if a shell hits a hospital. But the direct hits were too frequent for them to be said to be random.
What was the sort of ethnic situation? You know, was that something that was rather complex to understand, yeah, did you find?
Terribly complex. Places like Bihac were pretty much Muslim strongholds. So mostly the people living in and around Bihac were Bosnian Muslims anyway. And people just didn't hate the Serbs and the Croats, but they just tended to live separately, much like perhaps in this part of London, the Bangladeshis live in one part and others live in others. But it's okay, and people rub along together. Later on, when I went to Sarajevo, you saw a much, much more intermingled and mixed up ethnic mixture, and then it became more difficult to understand. But these people just lived side by side within their own different communities. And Bihac was, as I say, it was quite Muslim, and I think it was evidently Muslim. The women wore headscarves, they wore long clothes. They didn't look as free and liberated as Westerners like us, and perhaps not as free and liberated as some of the Serb and Croat women in the cities. But that was because they were a rural people, I think, and their Islamic identity maintained itself more strongly in a rural setting. But they weren't so Islamic that they didn't drink or really stuck closely to the laws of Islam. There were mosques, and people sometimes went to the mosque and sometimes didn't. They certainly weren't fanatics. They weren't religious fanatics in any way. And this thought of a fear of an Islamic takeover is a bit strange to me, because it was more of just an identity that they perhaps developed even stronger in the war, because it made them feel that they were being pushed into being like this, because the Serbs said, you're Muslims. They would have just perfectly happily lived as they did before, not wanting to assert their Muslim beliefs on anybody, but just getting on with their country lives, really. Yes, around Bihac it's very rural, and everybody is a farmer, really. And so people would just get on with their lives, living very peacefully in the countryside and working on their farms. And I don't think that there was any great hatred between ethnic groups around Bee Hatch area. People lived quite peacefully beforehand, and they were united in that they were all country people. And it really is a very rural place, quite sort of outdated rural machinery that you'd see, and a lot of donkeys, horses and carts. I was quite surprised how much of that all over Bosnia there is, and even in rural England today you see people more in cars, but in rural Bosnia you see people on horses and carts. And that was across the ethnic divide, Serbs, Croats, Muslims, just country folk.
Did you experience much in the way of, you know, injuries that you had to deal with when you were in Bee Hatch? I was wondering about this trauma aspect,
yes.
You know, that you were being prepared for.
Less again in Bee Hatch than later on in Banja Luka and in Sarajevo. In Bee Hatch, as I say, I wasn't directly involved really with the wounded. We supplied the hospitals with the means to operate on those wounded. If there was heavy shelling, I stayed in. It was too dangerous to be out. I mean, I would be no good to anybody if I was killed. So everybody just stayed in if there was shelling. Later on, I was moved from Bee Hatch to Banja Luka. Now, Banja Luka, in contrast, is a Serb-held part of northern Bosnia. And it's actually a very, very political place. Banja Luka was the centre of the Bosnian Serb army, and there was a lot of military training that went on around there. There was great evidence of weapons held around there, produced around there. So there was great feeling of Serb nationalism around Banja Luka. And sadly, it's an area from which there was a great deal of ethnic cleansing that went on around Prijedor, Sanski Most, towns within a short drive of Banja Luka. Now, Banja Luka had, before the war, quite a lot of Muslims in it, although it was a Serb, mostly Serb, area around northern Bosnia. Many, many of the Muslims fled. Many others were encouraged to leave. Many left, and many died. And it was then that I really came much more into contact with the direct traumatic results of that war. And people who had died, not or been killed or been, sorry, tortured or badly treated, not through conventional weapons of war, not through dying under the bullet in a trench or being killed by a shell, but people that were harassed so much, ill-treated, mentally abused, raped, their children taunted, their animals killed incessantly, day in, day out, that just wore them down. And I saw families who were so traumatised by the nighttime activities of their neighbours that they eventually just gave up and said they wanted to leave. And that's the kind of cleansing which is so unpleasant, really. The other sides say they left voluntarily, but you know what they were driven to, why they left voluntarily. It's quite difficult to talk about this because I'm very aware of the ICRC's policies on speaking about ethnic cleansing and about neutrality and about my position about speaking. And I need to say that there is and was very obviously evidence of cleansing on all sides. So nothing that I say relates only to what Serbs did to Muslims, what Muslims did to Serbs, or Croats to Muslims, or Croats, or whatever. This is cleansing per se. Obviously, because I was in Banja Luka, which was a Serb stronghold, and the minority group there was Muslims, my experience in this case was atrocities that Serbs committed against Muslims, but it's not by any means the whole story. As the ICRC, we were involved in protection, which is a bit of an ironic word, really, because how do you protect people from their neighbours, from their own villages, people who live around? And the best protection they wanted was to be taken out, to be sent to another country, to be evacuated. And of course we did have the means and the facilities to do that. But if the ICRC starts taking out countless numbers of Muslims from one area where they're vulnerable, then we are guilty in a way of ethnic cleansing ourselves, or we will certainly be said to be ethnic cleansing. And also we are perhaps doing the dirty work for the others themselves, and that's not what we're there for. Protection should mean protection within people's own environments, and we were unable to do that, and that is very depressing. And also I think I felt, and I'm sure the other ICRC delegates felt at times, that we'd failed people. And that's a really devastating thing to do, to feel, when you've come deliberately to be their source of help and you've let them down. We had people who would come battering on the door of the ICRC office in Banja Luka and to say, let me stay the night here, I'm not safe at home, please let my family in. In very exceptional circumstances we would, but they were very exceptional. Mostly we had to say to people, go home, go back to your own homes. And that person the next day might be dead. I mean, there were incidences where we actually failed people who tried to come for our protection and they went home and that was their last night. That's painful, and that's shameful, really. But that's happened. My involvement, because I was a field nurse and not a protection delegate or one of the Swiss delegates, my involvement was more to see the women who'd been raped, to take them to hospital if they wished to go. Those who feared to be pregnant, if they were, to gain terminations for them. Many of the women who were raped or claimed to be raped were too afraid to go to hospital because the hospitals had mostly Serb staff, and these were Muslim women who'd been raped by Serb men, and so they wouldn't go to hospital or they wouldn't go alone. So to go with them, to escort them to hospital. Many of the women refused to go to hospital even with my escort. Mercifully, most of them didn't conceive when they were raped anyway. The other part of my job was to see the people that had been badly beaten, and I saw some horrific injuries and patched up some unpleasant sights of gain of people who would be far too afraid to go to hospital to show what had happened to them. And you know, I often felt, but you need to go to hospital, I don't know, you might have more severe head injuries under those cuts and lacerations and bruises. You need to have a scan, you need to have further investigations. But these people wouldn't go. And in those instances, either I just had to trust that they would be all right, or they did become, some of them, our protection victims who we took out, and we took them out of Bosnia altogether. But there are certain criteria which a family has to fulfil in order to be evacuated as a protection victim family, because you can't have everybody, you can't take out every family. And so the criteria got more and more strict, really, and you had to be almost dead or have lost a relative, a member of your family, to cleansing action before you were considered vulnerable enough to be evacuated as a protection victim. Hard decisions, and they're often based on numbers, quotas. You know, so many need to be taken out of Banja Luka this week. I'm glad I wasn't involved in making those major decisions. That was up to the detention protection delegates of the ICRC based in Zagreb. Better for them, because they were more removed emotionally, they weren't there. I just had to write the medical report, either strengthening somebody's cause, well, usually strengthening somebody's cause, or saying that they really didn't have major medical difficulties in order to take them out. I remember one particular case of a young family. The guy was 29 and his wife was 25, and they had a 2-year-old daughter, and they were just farm people, and their neighbours had harassed them night after night after night, shouting around the house, firing guns at the windows, not into the house but just outside.